It was around 3 a.m. on a Saturday morning in 2003 when officers found Sean Rimmington crashed out drunk in the entrance to the lost property at a police station in central Leeds. The 18-year-old had been seen sexually harassing people in the street earlier in the night on CCTV. He was arrested and taken to a cell. During that time, he punched the arresting officer twice in the face. But it wasn't Sean who ended up in prison because of that night.
You're probably going to be putting me in a bag by end of day. You're going to kill me.
Not long after he was arrested, Sean left the police station in an ambulance, badly beaten and bleeding from a head wound. Police Constable Danny Major was alleged to have repeatedly attacked the 18-year-old as he hauled him out of the police van, and again later when he was in the cells. Because of this night, Danny Major would become a symbol of police brutality. But he always insisted that the accusations against him were a pack of lies, that it was a fix-up.
It's not enough to put somebody off, but if you got attacked, I could do some damage to somebody quicker than they could kill me, basically.
Only one officer claimed to have directly witnessed the assault, and the victim had been too drunk to remember who had attacked him. So, if it was a fix-up, how did the people responsible get away with it? How could it be possible for police officers to frame one of their own for a series of assaults that took place within the precincts of a police station where there were CCTV cameras positioned at every corner of the building?
It was the first time I'd slept in like days by that stage, because it was the first time I was, nobody could get to me.
We're taught to believe that our justice system is fair, that everyone is equal in the eyes of the law, and that it's almost impossible for an innocent person to go to prison for a crime they didn't commit. These are the stories of people who maintain their innocence and yet remain in prison, fighting unimaginable odds to win justice in a system that, many would say, is rigged against them. This podcast tells the stories of those on the outside fighting to free those on the inside. I'm Arnie Duke, and this is The Overturn.
My name's Danny Major. I'm an ex-West Yorkshire police officer. I was accused of assault in 2003.
We meet at his parents' house. His niece is there too when I arrive. She doesn't look that much younger than me, maybe in her early 20s. Danny tells me that she wasn't even born when this story began.
Grew up in Wakefield. My dad joined the police when I was about two. He retired, I think, in 2011. So he did 31 years.
Danny didn't have to think too hard about his career choice. As a young boy, he loved to hold the wheel of his dad's police car and wear his own miniature uniform.
As a child, I'd always wanted to be one, because just like most boys do, just want to be like the dad.
The young Danny had no illusions about the reality of being a police officer.
I mean, it was quite hard growing up with my dad in the police, because he worked shifts all the time. So sometimes, I remember as a teenager, even living in the same house, you go a full week without seeing him. Because he'd either be on on nights, so he'd be asleep when you're sort of doing stuff, or he'd just a crossover. Sometimes he'd come in, he'd get in at 11, he'd be out by 5 in the morning again. So you just, yeah, it were sort of a lot of time was having to be quiet during the daytime because he was asleep. But yeah, that was just part and parcel of your upbringing.
So did it seem like an admirable thing to do?
It did. There was an element of that. My dad was always one of these police officers that wasn't who he was. It was something he did, because it meant that he could have a house, have stuff for his family, could have holidays and things like that. It wasn't who he was. So there are a small clique of police officers that kind of make being in the police is who they are. And it's a bit weird, is that, if I'm honest with you. There are always people that you need to really be careful of, I find. I was still living here when I first joined the police. So I didn't even have a girlfriend, was no children, not married. So I was one of those people that would just work all the time.
Danny was just out of university at the start of what he thought would be a long career when he joined the force.
Yeah, I was looking at getting on. I'd already made provisions to sort of do my sergeant's exams. So I was like, well, I'd like to one day settle down. And then sort of 2003, I was accused of this. And that's where everything just sort of came apart, really.
It was alleged by a fellow officer that Major had pulled the 6'4" boy out of the van head first, smashing his face into the concrete before kneeing him in the head and punching him 3 times in the face. This had apparently taken place in direct view of the camera. Before Major left Rimmington, it was alleged he dropped down to one knee and punched him in the face 4 or 5 times. It was then said Major removed the young man's handcuffs and left him bleeding heavily on the floor. Danny didn't know about these accusations at the time. He just thought that a complaint had been made against him.
How are you feeling? How did you react?
Well, I'd had complaints made about me in the past. It's sometimes being a police officer, you upset people. Nobody likes being arrested. And sometimes people will just make complaints because that's what they do. And very often, it happened to me previously, somebody had made a complaint, but as soon as the charges against them were dropped, then they dropped the complaint. And like, you've just got to kind of take, if you're doing your job properly, you're going to upset people sometimes, and people are going to make complaints. So it's just kind of part and parcel.
Like Danny says, having complaints made about you wasn't totally uncommon. Besides, the assault was alleged to have happened in a police station with CCTV cameras everywhere.
Leeds Bridewell had approximately 17 cameras. There was one camera that looked directly into the van dock.
The van dock. That's one of the places where Danny was accused of assaulting Sean Rimmington. According to Major, an alarm would sound when the tapes for the cameras needed changing. He says it would be impossible not to have the tapes recording, that the system was set up for that not to happen. So when he was first interviewed about the assault, he hoped the situation would be cleared up quickly by the CCTV evidence.
Right up until I was interviewed, I was looking forward to getting that tape out. So I'm like, well, you've got the... That tape's going to cover the van dock, so you'll see.
But that's not what happened. Only 2 of 6 relevant tapes were retrieved. And when the tapes were finally disclosed, 14 hours of video had been edited into 2 90-minute clips, which removed evidence that would have helped Major's defence. This included footage showing 2 officers who could have been witnesses arriving seconds before one of Major's alleged assaults took place. The official line was that a freak serial malfunction of technology had taken place, preventing the footage from being retrieved.
CCTV footage from inside the Bridewell, what we were given at the interview and at the trial, had been edited so that there were a few seconds before we came in, there were some officers from a nearby police station had come in with a prisoner, so they'd been in the van dock when we were. They were edited out, and then bits of them later on was edited out as well. So I didn't know about them until after the actual trial. At the interview, once we started getting into the sort of bits and pieces of it, and I was like, oh, actually, it looks like it's starting to be a bit of a fit-up. And then all of a sudden, I think it became a case of, well, either Danny's done it and Danny's a bad policeman and Danny's a bad person, or they've lied about him and we're going to have to arrest like 4 or 5 police officers for perverting course of justice. And just gone, that's really bad if we have to do that, so let's not. So they've just basically, and then once it started to fall apart, West Yorkshire Police have just kept betting on red, and they just put more and more stuff on it, and until eventually the first trial collapsed because they'd not done disclosure properly.
The rules on disclosure are simply stated. every unused item held by the police that is considered relevant to an investigation should be reviewed to see if it is capable of undermining the prosecution or assisting the defence. If either outcome is satisfied, it must be disclosed to the defence. In 2016, the Criminal Cases Review Commission said failure to disclose evidence was the single most frequent cause of miscarriages of justice.
The trial was supposed to start on a Monday. I think it was late 2005. And on the Saturday morning, I got a tip-off that one of the prosecution witnesses had been disciplined for a dishonest act. But we didn't know exactly what it was. Now, West Yorkshire Police at the time used to use a thing called the discipline register. So imagine if you were a police officer and a complaint's made about you or you do something wrong, you could obviously be interviewed and CPS could get involved. Or what if you've had a discipline finding against you? So there's been a discipline panel that said, well, actually, yeah, you've done something wrong. That's really out of order. But we're not going to sack you, we're going to give you a warning. You would then have to declare that for so many years. So then it all came out and it turned out that the prosecution witness had sexually assaulted a policewoman and it had been dealt with off the book. We then found out there were a load of other stuff with the prosecution witness relating to honesty and integrity, visiting cells, conducting an interview with one person at a cell. I've never heard of that being done before. It was like something off Heartbeat. It was like that archaic. Real serious, this person shouldn't be a police officer stuff. All dealt with off the book.
This meant the police officer in question would no longer be a reliable witness.
So judge just went, you know what, we can't carry on with this. We'll stop the trial. And then we had a 2-week abuse of process hearing. So the trial can't go ahead today. Let's try and get to the bottom of what's going on. And that was 2 weeks. Then we had a trial in, I think, April 2006. By this stage, I was fighting for my life, effectively.
Danny was accused on 3 accounts. 1, of kicking Sean Remington in the van. He was acquitted of that because the injuries just didn't match up. 2, of spearing him outside of the van dock. That should have been accounted for by the CCTV cameras, which had the freak malfunction. And 3, assaulting him in the cell. The footage, which showed 2 possible witnesses to that alleged assault, was also not disclosed.
I don't think I really stood a chance with the jury, because they weren't given all the evidence for a start, but it felt very much as though it wasn't a case of they're trying to prove I've done it, I've got to prove I've not done it.
The jury convicted Danny on 2 of 3 accounts.
What was your experience in prison as a police officer?
Not great. They sent me to Armley, which was Leeds prison. And then West Yorkshire Police very helpfully gave the Yorkshire Evening Post a picture of me when I got an award. And then all those pictures go to all the prisons in the north of England. So that became an issue. They said initially they were going to keep me separate. And then the prison service tried to move me to Durham, where they still get the Yorkshire Post. They got me out of the van. I think I'd been in custody a few days from then. I think being in the van was the first time I'd slept in like days by that stage, because it was the first time nobody could get to me. I then just flat out refused to go into the general population. For like, well, I'm just going to stick you in with everybody else. And I was like, well, 4 days ago, my face were all over paper. I was like, I'm literally, you're probably going to be putting me in a bag by end of day. You're going to kill me. So I just said, look, I'm not doing it. And
Danny spent the next 2 weeks in solitary confinement because the prison guards just didn't know what to do with him.
During that period, I grew a beard. My hair got longer and scruffy. I had a lot more hair then.
To try and disguise yourself?
Yeah, so because when I'd been on the paper, I'd have been clean shaven. So I grew a couple of, probably a bit longer than I have now. It made me look quite a lot different. And then they moved me to Kirkham in Preston, And then I had to come up with a legend, sort of what the police call it, a background as to why I was there, because obviously got people ask questions, but I just kept myself to myself, just made sure that I got up and got showered well before everybody else got up, so I get up an hour or two before everybody else.
Danny arrived as a fit young man who had just completed the Great North Run. But after 2 weeks in solitary confinement, he says he couldn't walk 30 yards without his legs being in agony, because he'd been locked up for 24 hours a day in a single room.
Yeah, it was difficult to sleep because the doors were really flimsy, like internal doors. So if somebody really wanted to get to you, they could get to you. So you always had to be prepared. Even eating a meal, going to the dining hall, literally just get in, eat as quickly as you can and just get out, but always be sort of like now. So I feel safe here, so it's not an issue, but I know where doors are, I know where windows are. You couldn't really carry, you couldn't have a weapon, but there was certain stuff that you could fashion sort of quickly. So I always carried like a fork with me. It's not enough to put somebody off, but if you got attacked, I could do some damage to somebody quicker than they could kill me, basically. It took me over a year to get a job when I came out and ended up working at a call centre in Leeds at British Gas for basically minimum wage. So I started there in 2008. That's where I met my wife.
The family were determined to clear Danny's name, but all they got was a failed visit to the Court of Appeal and a rejected application to the Criminal Cases Review Commission. So they decided to bypass the official systems and take matters into their own hands. Through their campaigning, they persuaded the local police and crime commissioner to refer Danny's case to the policing watchdog, which asked the neighbouring force, Greater Manchester Police, to investigate what had happened at West Yorkshire. This was called Operation Lamp. Operation Lamp identified 10 classes of materials that should have been disclosed by West Yorkshire Police, but were not. These included the videotapes and 4 scene of crime photographs. Also absent were any details about the disciplinary record of one of the officers making allegations against Danny. The credibility of this witness should have been key, but what the jury didn't know was that shortly after the alleged assault against Sean Remington, the officer had been disciplined for a number of incidents of misconduct. Operation Lamp also refused to accept the allegation that Danny speared Sean Remington in the van dock. According to the report, his injuries were inconsistent with such a claim. It concluded that the officer accusing Danny had more than likely visited Remington in his cell, despite his denials, and that he had had a 23-minute meeting with a superior immediately after Remington went to the hospital. It's not clear what they discussed. Danny believes the officer panicked, thinking Remington was about to die, and decided to pin the blame on an expendable young officer.
Paramedics initially thought he had some really serious injuries, but it turned out he hadn't. And then the people that were at the cell there basically came up with a story to accuse me of assault. I'm quite fortunate, although it doesn't sound it, in they've done such a bad job at fitting me up that they got all the injuries completely wrong, because they were trying to make it match what they thought the paramedics had said initially. Which they thought that Remington had a fractured skull, which he didn't. They thought he'd been kicked in the ribs, but that turns out to be somebody completely different in the custody suite. So they made a pretty bad job of fitting me up.
Operation Lamp blew the Danny Major case wide open.
Once Operation Lamp came out, we should have just basically been allowed to go straight to the Court of Appeal. But the CCRC refused to give over power, because once they've done it once, that's it, it's over for them.
It's spring 2025 when I come across Danny's case in the news. A recent headline reads, "Real possibility jailed PC was the victim of miscarriage of justice." Danny's been out of prison for nearly 20 years, but only now might have the chance to overturn his conviction and clear his name. That's because the Criminal Cases Review Commission, the independent body set up to investigate miscarriages of justice, has only now referred his case because they say that there is new evidence that raises a real possibility the Court of Appeal will quash his convictions. It's been 10 years since the publication of Operation Lamp, but only now, in 2025, has the Criminal Cases Review Commission referred Danny's case to the Court of Appeal. So what have they been doing for the last 10 years?
But for whatever reason, we've got to go through the CCRC, which is just 10, just absolute 10 years of delay. Everyone seems obsessed with what the process is, but the processes are as clear as mud, and nobody's really interested in what's actually the right and wrong thing to do. It's just insane. And then all of a sudden, 20 odd years later, I'm sat here talking to you about it. And everybody else that's been involved and committed a criminal act or is so incompetent has either retired on a nice fat pension or has been promoted. And that's just, I don't know, but that's not right.
Danny is now waiting to hear back from the appeals division to see whether they'll fight him on it or not.
It's frustrating because because it doesn't affect a large amount of people, everyone seems to be quite satisfied that a justice system doesn't work and innocent people are going to jail. And there's only really the people that are affected are actually interested in it. People just aren't interested because it just lets people know that how they live their normal day-to-day lives, the justice system just does not work at all from start to finish. I'm an example of every single safeguard that is in place has just been bypassed. We need something in place, but the CCRC is absolutely not the way to do it. They're supposed to be independent, but the report that I received, the statement of reasons, spent more time trying to cover the CCRC's back than actually deal with a wrongful conviction. Andy Malkinson and my case are both 20 years old. So there's effectively 20 years of cases between now. So are we going to be sat here in 2045 talking about something that happened like last week? Well, if we carry on with the same system, yeah, we're basically saying to people, if you're wrongfully convicted, you need to be fighting for 25 years. And if after 25 years, we'll probably take you seriously. That's basically what Andy Malkinson's found and what I found. The evidence doesn't matter. Yeah, the CCRC will cover its back no matter what.
Aside from ruining his reputation, Danny has spent 20 years paying for legal fees.
It's been a massive, massive commitment because I left university in 2000 and then this all happened. And so I've been completely financially ruined by it. So I need to be able to start rebuilding my life. And I hold people at the CCRC, as well as West Yorkshire Police and CPS, personally responsible for that. And I think they should have to pay for that.
Danny's dad, Eric, had to remortgage his home to release £30,000. But it was quickly eaten up with legal fees before the trial concluded. He was only able to pay it off when he cashed in his pension on retirement.
I would have expected, had this have been resolved 10 years ago, they would have got the legal fees back plus interest and him and my mum could have done something with the retirement. But now my dad's 70 this year and my mum's dead. She wasn't very old when she died. She was 64 when she died. Her mum and dad lived well into the 70s and 80s. I think the stress of this is because it was all consuming. Yeah, it was, because that's the only way you can deal with it. If you're not all consumed by it, you just can't fight on. And yeah, I think the stress of this, it was morning, noons, and night, morning, noon, night for 20 years. And yeah, I think it the stress of this is probably what killed her. My mum was the person that became a real stone in the shoe of people because she just would not let go. Which right, so she shouldn't have had to. But yeah, I think when I wasn't strong enough to keep going, she was. And I think she probably kept my dad going as well with, I think the stress ultimately is what killed her.
It's taken many years for the truth to start to emerge about how Sean Rimington ended up in hospital after being arrested by West Yorkshire Police back in 2003. But in the case of Danny Major, it seems like alarm bells rang every step of the way. At every stage of the legal process, there was issues with disclosure. Danny Major was jailed on the basis of a single police officer's evidence. But can we trust a justice system when it relies entirely on the impartiality of its officers? And why has it taken 20 years to give him a fair trial? In the next episode, I find out why the family of a stab victim believe the wrong man is in prison for his murder.
I wouldn't trust them as far as I could throw them. I think they fabricate evidence to suit their narrative. It's wrong. It's morally wrong on every level.
This series is a production of the Future Justice Project. It's produced and presented by me, Marnie Duke. Executive producers are John Robbins and Callum McRae.